Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. This week, we're mapping out the impact and importance of the small but mighty compass, the consequences of its invention on our world, how it informed navigation technology that came after it, and how it continues to be an essential tool. There's also something just really neat about it.
Oh, my name is Gary Arndt, and I am the host of Everything Everywhere Daily, a podcast where you can learn something new every day, like the history of the compass. I was an Eagle Scout here in the U.S., and so one of the things that you had to learn was orienteering. So you had to learn how to use a compass and a map. And this was way before GPS technology or anything like that. So you had to be able to figure out where you were on a topographic map and how to find your place from A to B using orientation. And then later on, when I went to college, I studied geology and geophysics. And in the field, we'd have to use what's called a Brunton compass. And you'd have to use the same skills that you actually had to use in Boy Scouts in terms of orienteering, but you also used it to determine the direction and fold of rocks. So you would need to know what the angle something was sloping at, the direction a bed of rock was lying. And Brunton compasses are still used in the field today by geologists. So it's still an important tool.
And was there something about using the compass that struck you as like a moment where you're like, wow, this is really cool?
Oh, yeah, because how a compass finds its bearings is going to be different depending on where in the world you are, because magnetic north is not the same as true north. So you have to compensate for it. And where I grew up at the time in Wisconsin, we had zero compensation. And I always thought that was kind of cool that we were right on the zero line. So yeah, it was always cool to me that, you know, you could use this little floaty needle inside of a device to find your way around. And even, you know, outside of that, I always remember my grandmother in her car, she had a compass. Right where you'd have your rearview mirror, and it was kind of a floating ball, so you could always just see what direction you were at.
Oh, yeah. I remember those.
I'm Richard Langley. I am a professor in the Department of Geodesy and Geomatics Engineering at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton. Around 1874, the then president of the University of New Brunswick established a meridian line, which is oriented to true north or geographic north, and could use that to basically measure the deflection of a compass, because a compass pointing to magnetic north, that's not the same as true north. So William Brighton Jack, the president of UNB at the time, established this meridian line so he could actually calibrate the compasses and tell whether or not there was any defect in the compass and what the offset in their pointing was with respect to true north.
So where and when can we trace the origin of the magnetic compass?
There's the compass and there's the compass effect. So the Earth has a magnetic field, and it was first discovered that the Earth had a magnetic field about 2,000 years ago in ancient China. It was found by using something called a lodestone, which is really just a stone that's very rich in the mineral magnetite. So it's very rich in iron. But they took a lodestone and they could tie a string to it, and it became known as the south pointing fish. And We always consider a compass pointing north, but in reality, it's the same thing, right? It's just a needle aligning on a north-south axis. So whether you choose to call it north or south, it's just a matter of convention. But for centuries, this was used for nothing more than fortune-telling, geomancy, and feng shui. It was not used for navigation. It was just something you would put on a string, and it was either a novelty or something you'd use for mysticism.
So even before the invention of the actual physical compass, this idea of the compass effect had already been discovered.
Right. And it may have been the case that in the Americas, it was discovered by the Olmec people in Central America as well. We don't have written records, so we don't know, but they found some objects that seem like it could have been lodestones and using the same type of thing that the Chinese had. The other thing that the Chinese developed at the time, in addition to the just putting it on a string, was a magnetic spoon. Like a spoon like you would get if you're out eating pho or something like that. They're deeper.
Yes.
And they would create a spoon out of the lodestone, and it would, no matter how you orientated the spoon, because it was only resting on a little spot under the bowl, it would orientate itself with the magnetic field. And so this was far more of a party favor than just hanging something, you know, on a piece of thread. But the first big advance came in the 7th century when they discovered that you could rub a needle against a lodestone and make the needle magnetic. And that changed everything. So instead of a piece of rock, you could now have something that was very lightweight that also achieved the same function as a very heavy piece of stone.
Right. And this all basically works because of the magnetic properties of the Earth's core. Is that right?
Right. So in the outer core, not the inner core, which is solid, but the outer core, it's primarily iron and nickel, both of which are magnetic elements. And there's convection within this liquid outer core. And that convection causes electric fields, which then causes magnetic fields. And that's what's responsible for the magnetic field of the Earth.
I see.
So at the heart of a conventional compass is a magnetized needle. And that needle aligns itself with the magnetic field lines of the Earth's magnetic field. We probably all took a look at magnetic field lines in high school when we did the physics experiment with iron filings with a bar magnet underneath. Essentially, that's what the compass is doing, except with the Earth's magnetic field. So the magnetic needle, therefore, points to magnetic north.
The development of that needle was something that you could, if you were very tricky about it, it could float on the surface tension of water, or you could put it on a leaf or a piece of paper, most probably in China. And in the 11th century was the first documented evidence we have of a compass being used for land navigation. And then in the 12th century, we know that the Chinese were using it for naval navigation. And this was a huge leap because prior to this, you had to see the shore to know what was happening, right? To navigate yourself. So the ancient Romans in the Mediterranean, they never liked to go straight through the Mediterranean. They always preferred to stay near shore where they knew where they were. If a storm arose, they could find shelter, and it made navigation much easier. The only ancient people that we know of that were able to navigate open ocean water without the aid of a compass were the Polynesians. And they had an incredible system where they could use the stars and a whole host of other natural features to be able to navigate in the open waters of the Pacific without a compass. And the fact that they didn't have a compass makes their accomplishments all the more impressive.
Yeah.
So by the 12th century, we know that the Chinese were using this for naval navigation. Most of the inventions that we think of as coming from China to the West usually came through Islamic traders.
Okay.
Coming up from the east coast of Africa, in through Southeast Asia, and then eventually up to, say, southern China. And in fact, the great Chinese explorer Zheng He was a Muslim eunuch from China, and Islam had already spread that far. So things like a lot of papermaking techniques, playing cards, gunpowder, all kind of went through this trade route where they came from China and worked their way west. In the case of the compass, the first evidence we have of it appearing in Europe actually appears in England, and it appears before the first evidence of it arriving with Islamic traders.
Oh.
And this is what we don't know. Either it was independently discovered in Europe somehow, or it traveled very quickly through Europe, which is entirely possible and quite frankly probable, and it just wasn't documented.
So how reliable was the compass as a navigational tool during that first early period where we start to see it mentioned in Western literature?
Good, but imperfect. It could tell you where north was. So if you're out in the middle of the ocean and you have no landmarks, or even if you're off the coast and it's very foggy, which is a common occurrence, it was much better than nothing. The problem was that ships would rock. And if you're trying to just balance a simple needle on some water, it's not the best way, you know, on a rocking ship, it's not going to work very well. So there were developments, and a lot of those developments solving the practical problems of a compass at sea were actually solved in Europe. And one of those was the creation of basically a card. You know, you're familiar with like a north, south, east, west, northwest, southeast, that kind of thing. The card floats on water and you magnetize part of the bar in the middle. And then it's a lot easier for the whole thing to float. And if you can contain the water, then it's not going to slosh around as much.
And you need it to be on the water so that, essentially so that it can move easily and respond to magnetic north. Is that right?
Yeah, but there were also dry ones that were made as well, where a needle would simply be set on a pin and allowed to rotate. But even today, a lot of the higher-end compasses will have some sort of liquid that it floats on. Mm-hmm.
As Gary Arndt said, the compass enabled naval navigation and the ability to go far out to sea. Before the invention of the mariner's compass, maritime seafaring was relegated to the spring and summer months when the skies were clearer and days were longer. And that had global consequences for the creation of trade routes and posts, but also for European expansionism in the early modern period, the transatlantic slave trade, and the rise of colonialism. So what were some of the unexpected, you know, more societal consequences of the compass's invention?
Well, the biggest one was it allowed for ships to make much longer voyages without having to see the shore. And in large part, that allowed for the colonization of the New World. Because one of the odd things that people don't realize is that the Americas were settled before Europeans actually colonized Africa. The colonization of Africa primarily took place in the 19th century, by which time most of North and South America had already been overrun with Europeans. But that was largely due to the fact that they had better navigation. And once they started taking ships there, they were able to start creating maps. And, you know, the big thing that they didn't know was the ability to set longitude. So they were able to tell latitude very easily with a sextant and the sun. Longitude was very difficult. That's a whole nother story. But once that was settled, you could orientate yourself with a compass. You could determine your latitude with a sextant, and ultimately longitude with a clock was how they did it. But that was, it was the 18th, early 19th century by the time that was established.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, the sixth in our series, The Butterfly Effect, we've been talking about the compass. My guests are Gary Arndt, a photographer and host of the podcast Everything Everywhere Daily, and Richard Langley, a professor in the Department of Geodesy and Geomatics Engineering at the University of New Brunswick. We've heard how the discovery of the compass effect in China and the consequent invention of the technology years later eventually led to the expansion of European exploration, trade, and colonialism. By the time we reached the 20th century, were there further evolutions of the compass?
Most of the improvements were just technical improvements in like ship compasses. The creation of a large ship compass that, you know, can, you'll have some sort of gimbal or some sort of balance where if the sea is rocking, the compass will remain somewhat steady. Those kinds of innovations were really the biggest ones. But I would say that by the time of the 19th century through the 20th century, there wasn't a lot of radical innovation in the compass. If you think about it, a simple compass today is not that far off from what would have been used in China over 1,000 years ago.
Wow.
It is a magnetized piece of metal that's usually put on some sort of pin or in, you know, some sort of a liquid where it will float. And it's a bit more sophisticated maybe than what was used in ancient China, but it's fundamentally the same thing. One of the big differences was the creation of geomagnetic maps. So like I said, because the declination is different in different places because the magnetic pole is constantly moving, in the 18th and 19th centuries, the British began creating maps so navigators would know how much to offset your compass by depending on where you were.
The compass has evolved over time to take on different forms. I know that the electronic compass is one of the more common kind of recent iterations. So what's the difference between the electronic compass and what we know as the magnetic compass?
So electronic compasses or magnetometers, to give them their official name, work on different physical principles. They don't involve a piece of magnetized metal. And there are several different technologies that have been and are being used to make compass measurements. And perhaps the most recent of these are devices that can be made incredibly small. They're called microelectromechanical systems. And they can construct these microscopic, as the name might suggest, but they can measure the magnetic field in three dimensions, and that can be coupled with a three-dimensional gyroscope. And all that is on a tiny integrated circuit, and we have those in our smartphones. Have you ever used the electronic compass on your smartphone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in the utilities on my phone, yeah.
There you go. That compass can tell you the direction to magnetic north, but sometimes it has a built-in table of these offsets or declinations, so it can tell you true north. But it's making a basic measurement of magnetic north and then correcting it to show you true north or geographic north, since that's what we typically use these days.
I don't know if it's a direct trace, but certainly the creation of the global positioning system was sort of the next logical step. So let's say in World War II, bombers would go on bombing missions, and they were notoriously ineffective. Mm. Like, you would send waves of planes filled with bombs, you drop them over a factory in Germany, and maybe one or two would hit. And that was literally what they planned for. And that's why they had to do this sort of the carpet bombing. And then in the decades after, it was like, well, this is really inefficient. And they came up with this idea for a global positioning system. The thing is, though, a global positioning system cannot tell you your direction. So let's say you pull up your phone right now and it'll show you where you are on a map.
Yes.
But it can't show you the direction you're facing. It can only show you where you are unless you move.
Right.
So in cell phones today, I know all iPhones have them, is a compass. There's a magnetometer in the compass, and there's a compass app that most people may not even know is there, but you can pull up the compass app and use your phone as a compass. Because it's basically doing it a bit more sophisticated. It's not a needle or anything, but it's using a magnetometer to determine your orientation. So the combination of a compass and a GPS can give you location and direction if you're not moving. It's more important, I suppose, if you're walking probably than driving, where if you're driving, you're going to have motion and you can determine, compare two points and see the direction. But it's really helpful if you've ever been in a large city and you want to know walking directions to a place.
Yeah.
That's when a compass is still going to come in handy.
So, I mean, centuries after its invention and with all the various navigational tools out there, how important does the compass continue to be?
Oh, it's extremely important. So a few years ago, I had the pleasure of landing on a nuclear aircraft carrier, and I got to stay overnight and they launched me on it and I got to see the bridge, and they still have a compass on every ship, whether it's a commercial ship, a military ship, they have to have a compass.
Huh.
Because GPS systems can be jammed. They theoretically could go down. You might not have a good signal. And knowing the navigational skills with a compass is still something that everybody needs to know. Orienteering is a sport, and it's been under consideration as a sport for the last several Olympics. And it's a combination of both navigation and cross-country running. So you have to, it's like cross country, except you have to figure out where the track is. And your time is based on your ability to both run and figure out the course.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another application for the use of compasses today.
Gary Arndt is a photographer and host of the podcast Everything Everywhere Daily.
You are listening to Spark with Nora Young on CBC Radio.
So, as you heard, you can still use a compass on a smartphone to find your way around, but practically speaking, for many of us, wayfinding technology means using GPS and a global navigation satellite system called GNSS. Here's University of New Brunswick's Richard Langley.
So, GPS was there first, the global positioning system. It was developed starting around 1973. In 1978, they started to launch the first test satellites. It went through an extended testing period, and around 1995, it was declared fully operational. And at that time, widespread consumer use of GPS took off. Even though geodesists and surveyors had been using GPS with the test satellites and the initial operational satellites for the past decade. But shortly after the GPS satellites were being launched, the Soviet Union came along with its version of GPS called GLONASS, and they developed a constellation of satellites, ran into problems after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but eventually they got the system fully operational again. But also in the meantime, the Europeans developed their system called Galileo, and the Chinese developed a system called Beidou. So Global Navigation Satellite System is the generic term for any one of those four systems. So today we talk about GNSS receivers because they can receive the signals from one or more of these constellations of satellites.
And so, we depend on GPS and more broadly the global navigation satellite system to tell us how to get where we're going. But what are some of the current limitations of these navigation technologies?
The signals from global navigation satellite system satellites are fairly weak. They're considerably weaker than cell phone signals, for example. So they can't easily make it through roofs and walls of buildings. They can't penetrate into underground parking areas. They're blocked by tall buildings. So downtown on Front Street, you've got neighboring streets, a lot of tall buildings, which will block many of the signals from these satellites. The signals are also going to bounce off the buildings before they get to the receiver. And so the positioning accuracy in such environments might be quite poor. You need at least four satellite signals in order to determine your three-dimensional position and to synchronize the clock in the receiver. And those signals, preferably from the satellite, should be spread out in the sky. So if they're coming in a very narrow channel above you, the positioning accuracy will not be very good. Furthermore, the signals can be interfered with. They can be jammed or otherwise suffer interference. And again, you won't have very good positioning accuracy under such circumstances. Now, you can have a more robust system which uses GNSS plus other sensors, such as an inertial navigation system. In the cell phone, we have gyroscopes. We also have accelerometers. We basically have a miniature inertial navigation system in our smartphones along with the GNSS module. And so they can work together to improve the resilience of navigation and positioning when you're using a smartphone.
So you talked about the issue of things being jammed. Is it possible for them to be sort of maliciously jammed, or are these just...
Yes. In fact, that's going on right now in Ukraine. We've all seen the news stories about how the Ukrainians are using drone technology to view the adversary, aim the weapons. But the drones use GPS in order to position themselves and to fly from one place to another. So the Russians are, in many cases, trying to jam the signals that the drones are receiving. Also, it's well known around the Kremlin, GPS receivers don't work.
Oh.
That's because the signals in the vicinity of the Kremlin and in other places in Russia are being jammed so that any technology relying on GPS can't be used against officials or what have you in Russia.
Beyond malicious forms of interference, there are also ways nature and particularly space weather can interfere with navigation.
The sun emits radiation, both corpuscular particles, high energy, and radio waves. And both of those interact with the Earth's atmosphere and the magnetic field in various ways that we call space weather. And the Earth's magnetic field can be perturbed by the emissions from the sun. So we will see that even in a compass or magnetometers. In fact, the Geological Survey of Canada has a network of very precise magnetometers across the country, which is measuring the components of the Earth's magnetic field. And it's one kind of sensor system that we use to monitor space weather. Space weather also has an effect on GNSS. Because the signals from the satellites are coming down through the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is affected by the interaction between the sun and the Earth's magnetic field, that when we get the signals in our receiver on the ground, they can be disturbed. Sometimes worse than others. When there's, for example, what's called a coronal mass ejection of material off the sun. But even in benign conditions, because of the existence of the ionosphere, the ionized part of the atmosphere, there's a delay for the signals coming down to receivers on the Earth's surface. That delay has to be taken care of in some way to increase the positioning accuracy of GNSS receivers. It's done to a certain degree. It's one of the reasons why many GNSS devices now use two radio frequencies, because the satellites transmit on multiple frequencies. And if your receiver can use two or more frequencies, it can actually work out the effect of the ionosphere and reduce it almost completely in determining a position. So we get very high accuracies with these more evolved GNSS receivers.
Yeah. Wow. I know that back in October, the European Space Agency announced some plans for low Earth orbit navigation satellites. Can you explain what those are?
Low Earth orbiting satellites are satellites, as the name suggests, in low Earth orbit. What does that mean? Anywhere from about 400 kilometers up to maybe 2,000 kilometers. The International Space Station is a LEO, or low Earth orbiting satellite, a big one. But there are also very many satellites in low Earth orbits used for science, for military uses, and also for communications. A number of countries are developing these worldwide webs in the sky to provide telecommunications, web access via satellites. Very important if you live out in the boonies where you don't perhaps even have cell phone coverage. How do you get on the web? Well, these companies are developing systems to provide that. And what they're doing is leveraging on the satellite's communications capabilities by also using them for positioning, navigation, and timing, or PNT, as it's referred to. A number of systems are in development, including one by SpaceX, Elon Musk's company. They're putting up hundreds of satellites that will provide much stronger signals than GNSS satellites. And so that's the promise that the technology based on LEO positioning, navigation, timing will work indoors and be more robust, less sensitive to jamming and other kinds of interference. But there's already one system in existence, the Iridium constellation of satellites. I think there are 66 operational satellites there. They already have a system they're offering to subscribers. these are not necessarily going to replace GPS and the other global navigation satellite systems, but they can complement or supplement the GNSS signals.
So it would be like a kind of layered satellite navigation?
Yeah. Yeah. And so you'll have a combined system, which will then be more robust. So should you lose GPS signals, for example, you may still have signals from one of these LEO constellation systems.
And is there a limit to how fine-grained this kind of navigation can get? Like, is there a point at which we just can't get any more specific about where exactly something is?
Well, speaking from my own experience as a geodesist, you can use GPS and the other global navigation satellite systems to determine positions extremely accurately, would you believe, to better than 1 centimeter.
Wow.
In fact, with permanent installations of GNSS receivers, different places over the world, we can actually measure the slow motion of the Earth's tectonic plates. The North American plate is moving away from the Eurasian plate by a couple of centimeters a year. We can measure that. We can measure silent earthquakes, motion of the land, which is happening slowly in earthquake-prone areas. It can then be used to study the earthquake process, get a better handle on how earthquakes happen, whether we'll eventually be able to predict earthquakes, especially the devastating ones like we've seen recently in Turkey and in Syria, still an open question. But the more monitoring we do, the more scientific investigations we carry out, the closer we might get to that eventuality.
You are listening to Spark with Nora Young
on CBC Radio.
Now, obviously, when we talk about navigation and wayfinding, as we've been doing today, a lot of the focus is on outdoor exploration. But there are developments taking place in indoor navigation and positioning technology, too.
GNSS doesn't work well indoors because the signals are weak. They don't get through walls and ceilings. So techniques have been developed using cell phone signals because they're so much stronger. They will work indoors. Typically not as accurate as GNSS can be in the open air, but some positioning capability is better than no positioning capability.
I think everyone is familiar with using GPS outside, and the trick with GPS is that it only works outside. My name is Kyle O'Keefe. I'm a professor of geomatics engineering at the University of Calgary Schulich School of Engineering. I've been working in indoor positioning and navigation since 1999, so 24 years. If you are, let's say, sitting inside your suburban house, GPS might make it through the roof into the upstairs floor and maybe even the main floor, but probably not the basement. Now, if you go to a public place, for example, you know, an office building or the mall, chances are none of that signal is making it through the concrete and metal walls and roof, and so other technologies are required. Right now, the most common method of doing indoor positioning is for your phone to measure the signal strength of all of the Wi-Fi access points around you, and then compare that to something that they've measured before. Either other users or people have come in and measured specifically the signal strength at a number of different locations, and they compare that in a big table and try to figure out the most likely location for your phone.
Okay. So a phone is typically what's used, but are there other forms of technology that are used for indoor positioning?
Well, there are other sort of more specialized systems, especially before everyone had a smartphone in their pocket. Some sort of prototype systems were built for tracking valuable assets in, for example, hospitals or warehouses or construction sites. But most of them were using the same technology, just sampling Wi-Fi and comparing it to a lookup table. There are a couple of other really interesting technologies, though, that sort of started out slow and are just catching on right now. There's one that's called ultra-wideband ranging, and it's a special type of very low-power radio that was developed in the 1960s, actually, but it didn't really catch on until the early 2000s. And then it was just for very specialized sort of prototype systems for tracking things in indoors in commercial and industrial applications. But just recently, that technology has started to show up in smartphones and also in another product that's really been in the news lately called the AirTag, which is a really neat idea. And of course, over the last holiday season, it suddenly became very important for people to track their lost luggage. That allows you to make sort of a centimeter accurate distance measurement between two devices or objects at a very short range. And so it allows you to go from sort of tens of meters down to less than meter indoor positioning accuracy.
I see. And what about RFID? Is that considered part of indoor navigation technology?
Absolutely. Again, we all have it now. It's all on our tappable cards and other tags and things that we can wear. There's other examples where, you know, you can put tags on livestock or products. The trick with RFID is that you have to get really, really close to a reader in order for it to be read. But the nice thing about that is that when your tag is read, you know exactly where you are, if you know where the reader is. And so RFID makes a lot of sense if you are, you know, checking things in or out of a location or walking through a door, or you can imagine when you activate an elevator to unlock on a particular floor, well, now we know exactly what floor you're on.
And in fact, improvements are being made using cell phone signals to even be able to determine your position within a particular floor in a high-rise building, but also which floor you're on. Vitally important if you're a first responder trying to get to a certain location. Smoke-filled, you'd like to have a device that will tell you where you are and where you need to get to. There are other positioning technologies based on other kinds of radio signals, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi signals. They're all being worked on to develop alternative or complementary positioning services that will work indoors.
Richard Langley is a professor in the Department of Geodesy and Geomatics Engineering at the University of New Brunswick and innovation column editor at GPS World magazine.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young. This week on Spark's Butterfly Effect series, we're talking about the long-range influence of the compass and the evolution of navigation technology. Right now, we're focused on indoor navigation and positioning systems and the innovations happening in that area. Here's more with Kyle O'Keefe. So when did indoor navigation and positioning systems become an area of focus?
Right on the year 2000 is when GPS became something that, you know, regular people rather than specialists could use. And as soon as lots of people started realizing that they could have a 1 or 2 meter accurate position when they were outdoors, it started to create a demand for similar service indoors. Around the same time, in the late 90s, early 00s, there was a mandate from the communications regulators, specifically the FCC in the United States, but also Industry Canada and also in Europe, that emergency calls on mobile phones be automatically located. And I don't know if you've ever had to make a 911 call from your cell phone. I've done it three times. And every single time, the second thing that they ask is, where are you? You know, police, ambulance, fire. And of course, if you're having an emergency, you might not be able to answer that question. You might be unconscious, or there might be a security reason that you couldn't answer that question. You might be a small child. And with a landline, of course, you know where the landline is located, but with the mobile phone, you don't. So this started as an outdoor problem in the pre-GPS era with sort of first and second generation cell phones. A lot of work went into figuring out where the phone was just using the cell phone signal itself. And it seems kind of quaint now, but 25, 30 years ago, they assumed that people would want to keep their handsets forever and that you'd have to keep everything backwards compatible to the oldest handset still in service. Then in 2000, GPS sort of became public. It got shrunk down to chip size and started showing up on phones. And then once we had smartphones that had Wi-Fi on board as well, suddenly all the parts were there that you could say, okay, well, now we need to figure out where the phone is, and we can use that to satisfy this requirement of getting an emergency location.
Okay. So what is the goal with this technology?
You know, figuring out where you are for emergency purposes is a nice sort of regulatory goal. But of course, we're also the customers of this technology, and we like to be able to know where we are. And, you know, just the way that outdoor navigation has been adopted, that, you know, some people can't, they don't even feel comfortable driving without a GPS telling them where to go. Well, the same thing applies when you're looking for an office you've never been to or you're in the mall. And so it's a great location-based services is an entire industry built on figuring out where you are indoors and outdoors. Of course, there is the other side to this as well, which is that the service providers can really benefit from knowing where we are and use that information to sell us things more effectively. If you know where people go and where they shop, you can push them ads to try to change their habits or reinforce their habits. And so there's a huge opportunity there as well, which, you know, that's happening right now.
And isn't that something that people worry about, that if they have these kinds of things, they're going to have sort of the Minority Report, Mr. Anderton selling you, you know, Guinness or whatever as you walk through the mall, because there's that level of awareness of where you are and perhaps what your previous shopping habits are?
Absolutely. I think it's a huge problem for people who are worried about that. And I think that people, at least so far, have been willing to trade it for the convenience of having this free service that lets you find things easily. And there's all kinds of great, you know, examples where it's very useful, but there's also kind of some strange examples, you know, depending on your search history. They know where you are and they know what to suggest to you. And depending on what kind of device they're using, they may suggest, you know, here's a more expensive option or a less expensive option. If you've ever tried searching for a hotel room online, you know, you'll get different answers if you're using a different brand of phone, for example.
Yeah. So are we imagining a situation where you would have something along the lines of sort of Google Maps for all indoor spaces?
Well, we're already getting there. A lot of public indoor spaces are already mapped that way. And of course, for something specific like Google Maps, you know, Google Maps kind of goes where the Google cars can drive, but they also have teams that will walk indoor spaces, and you can have like a Google Street View of the indoor space, and they have a very precise location for where they've been. They're collecting all this other data at the same time, which will allow them or other service providers to give a fairly accurate location for the user. And then, yeah, you can do a sort of a street view of the mall. And it doesn't just have to be commercial. During the pandemic, a few public places did this. The Vancouver Art Gallery, for example, had put the gallery on Google Street View. So you could go and virtually walk around inside the gallery and see the stuff while the gallery was closed.
So how is artificial intelligence, things like computer vision, being used in this field?
It's actually very valuable because, you know, with GPS, we're measuring distances to satellites that are very far away. And we have what we call an expert model. You know, there's a physics model that says these measurements translate into this position exactly in this mathematical way. Whereas when you're positioning on things like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth signal strength, it's always been a statistical comparison. You collect a bunch of data, you try to compare that to what you've just measured and figure out the most likely location. So, you know, machine learning techniques can be trained with all of this data that has been collected either by professionally or by other users to try to give a better prediction of, okay, you've just made these measurements, you're near these access points, you're near this Bluetooth beacon of some sort, I think you're here. And also, I predict you're going to go, you know, there next. In terms of things like machine vision, obviously, navigation sensors to figure out where you are is one thing. But if you want sort of autonomous vehicles indoors, for example, you also need perception sensors to look for obstacles. And of course, they can identify, okay, you know, am I looking at a particular brand or another brand? And if I'm looking at a particular brand, then I'm probably standing in front of that location. Having those types of sensors on board is really important if you're going to have any kind of autonomy, because it's not just about knowing where you are, it's knowing not to crash into things, just like with autonomous driving.
Yeah. I'm Nora Young, and this time on our series, The Butterfly Effect, we're talking about the compass and newer innovations in wayfinding. Right now, I'm talking to Kyle O'Keefe, professor of geomatics engineering at the University of Calgary Schulich School of Engineering. We're talking about indoor navigation and positioning systems. Can you talk a bit about how indoor navigation might be useful in the context of assistive technologies for people with disabilities?
Yeah, that's a really big one. So guide dogs are very good at their job, and they're very expensive and difficult to train, and there's a big long waiting list. And so obviously, if you had a better position on your mobile device, like better than we have now, that could be used with a very high definition map to safely navigate, for example, a blind person through an indoor space or an urban space. And I think this is important as well, is that it's not just indoors, it's also in what we call urban canyons. So if you're downtown and you're surrounded by large buildings, GPS is not getting down there, or it's bouncing off the buildings. And so we use the indoor technologies when we're in close to indoors. So that's one example, is just, right now our phones can say, well, we're within 10 meters, let's say, but if you really wanted a device that said, well, make sure you are here, because if you move a meter to the left, you're now stepping off the sidewalk onto the road. You need more technologies on board, and you also need a better, a more accurate map.
Yeah. We touched on some of the sort of privacy issues here. How do you see overall the potential privacy implications of this type of technology? And are there any sort of best practices in terms of using indoor positioning systems when it comes to privacy?
I think what really matters is that the users are able somehow to see what the data is and have some control over how long it's saved and who gets to see it. And I think in the global West anyway, that progress is being made towards that. In some countries in Europe, a lot more progress than here. But of course, there are other examples of other totalitarian regimes that are monitoring the movements of all of their people all the time. And the laws have to keep up with the technology to make sure that that doesn't happen here.
Mm-hmm. Are there any recent developments or innovations in the space that you find particularly promising?
Well, I'm quite excited about the fact that ultra-wideband ranging radios have finally become chip-sized and made it into the latest smartphones. I and some of my grad students were working on that 20 years ago, and some of them now work for those companies that are doing it. And I think it will allow us to go from sort of the tens of meters type of position we have indoors to potentially not quite centimeters, but almost there when we need it. And it's a very good low-cost way of getting that level, sort of this many centimeters level of positioning. The trick is right now it's only the latest phones and there isn't a lot of infrastructure in place. Though the combination of that and Bluetooth low energy, which is very similar to Wi-Fi, but a lower power, closer signal, those two together are going to enable a lot of the next level of positioning indoors. There are also people who are doing some really interesting work on positioning with ultrasound, where you could have sound sort of beacons indoors that just the microphone on your phone could pick up and process and use that to measure a distance. And then you could use that to position very similarly to GPS. To make that work, though, requires a lot of infrastructure. And right now, what's interesting, of course, is that the Wi-Fi infrastructure is already there because we demand it when we're in public places. We want fast internet. 5G is very similar to that. There's going to be a lot more phone access points or stations at closer spacing in a lot of the urban areas, and that will be leveraged to get, a more accurate position when we're in urban areas.
Mm-hmm. And what about the challenges? I mean, what are the main challenges facing indoor navigation technology?
Well, I think the biggest challenge right now is that unlike outdoor, where GPS or more generally GNSS, what technology is going to be the technology hasn't been fully decided yet for the indoor one. I mean, Wi-Fi is the most adopted, but 20 years ago, public Wi-Fi wasn't a thing. 20 years from now, will it still exist or will it all just be 5G or whatever one we're at that time? And it's an interesting thing because every time there's a new technology, we have to test to see if it's going to benefit positioning indoors. And then we have to figure out if it's going to be the one that lasts.
And is it an issue that, you know, indoor spaces and the various pathways in them are different and might pose kind of unique obstacles?
I mean, there's both advantages and disadvantages to that. So some of the other sensors that are on the devices also contribute to indoor positioning. So for example, all phones have accelerometers and gyros. The most obvious use for the accelerometer is just figuring out which way is up with the screen because they sense the acceleration of gravity down, but they can also be used to do things like count steps. And so when you are indoors and the other technologies aren't working, you can do what's known as pedestrian dead reckoning, where you try to detect the steps and you try to measure the gait of the person that's walking with the device. It's a very interesting area of research too, because of course that looks different depending on where the device is. Is it in the person's hand? Is it in their pocket? Is it in a different pocket? Is it in their purse? And it looks different each time. Some of the higher end phones will have like a barometer on board measuring air pressure. And it's actually very useful because you can figure out what floor of a building you're on just from that. So just how to integrate all of those sensors. And then of course the sensors in the devices keep getting better. And so then every time they improve, the possibilities improve.
Earlier in the show, we talked about LEO navigation satellites, these low Earth orbit satellites. Do you see any promise for LEOs in indoor navigation?
Probably not in indoor, though maybe the people promoting that technology might disagree. But where it's really going to help is right before you go indoors. So if you're in an urban area and you're outside, but you don't have much of a view of the sky, the more satellites that you can make a ranging measurement off of from a navigation satellite signal, the better. And if you have, you know, just GPS, there's usually only 12 satellites or so in view, and maybe 3/4 of the sky is blocked by the buildings. If you add more systems, the chances of getting more signals increases. And then having these navigation payloads on low Earth orbiting satellites will only add to that. So one great thing about that is, you know, just as you walk up to a building, if you can know exactly what door you go in, well, then that makes the indoor navigation problem that much easier because your starting point is very well known. And that can be very helpful, even if inside the building, nothing is available and you just count your steps and use the inertial sensors to figure out where you're going. That's better than if you didn't know what door you entered the building on. So definitely having the low Earth orbiting navigation signals is going to help a lot for urban outdoor navigation. And then that will spill over a little bit into the indoor.
And so is something like a sort of perfectly seamless in outdoor to indoor pedestrian navigation incredibly fine-grained? Like, is that possible? Is that foreseeable in the reasonable future?
Well, that's the goal. Yeah. Right? That's exactly what we want. And a lot of research is going on around the world to improve that now. Once people are used to their very accurate outdoor position, they expect it to continue when they go inside. And sometimes it works. You know, if you have an indoor environment that has a lot of signals to measure, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and so forth, and has already been really well mapped. And of course, sometimes it doesn't. If you're going into a new building that no one has ever done the data collection on before. And so The real trick is that the users, every time it gets better outside, they expect it to be better inside. And providing that is a challenge that a lot of researchers and a lot of companies are spending quite a bit of effort making it better now.
Kyle O'Keefe is a professor of geomatics engineering at the University of Calgary, Schulich School of Engineering. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Michelle Parisi, Samarit Johannes, McKenna Hadley-Burke, and me, Nora Young. And by Gary Arndt, Richard Langley, and Kyle O'Keefe. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.